From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In Stephen Riley's documentary of Marlon Brando, Brando himself explains what the film is about. He's speaking on one of the dozens of personal audio tapes the actor recorded in his life. And in this case, he's talking in the third person about this troubled man beset with memories, isolated and sad, and looking back on his life.
Maybe he felt that he was treated badly and that he's angry about the treatment. He's collecting bits of information here, odd bits of film, to try to explain why are you this way.
Stephen Riley lets Brando himself, mostly just Brando, tell the story, and there are three parts: a boy, an actor, an old man. The film is called Listen to Me, Marlon, and it's now playing throughout the country. Stephen Riley will join us to talk about it today after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The actor Marlon Brando lived a tumultuous life. He was brilliant, of course. There's a long list of extraordinary roles, powerful, explosive parts on the waterfront, Streetcar Named Desire, The Godfather, Last Tango in Paris. But along with that brilliance came sometimes erratic and difficult behavior. Brando had always tried to be private about his life, and toward the end, he was particularly elusive. After his son was charged in a shooting at his home in Los Angeles and his daughter committed suicide, Brando retreated even further. He wasn't really speaking publicly in those days, but he was talking on tape. His estate had boxes and boxes of audio tapes where Brando would talk to himself and to others about the course of his life. The film director Stephen Riley has taken those tapes and created a beautiful and tragic portrait of Marlon Brando. It's called Listen to Me, Marlon, and it's just recently opened in theaters across the country. Today in the program, we're taking the opportunity to talk to Stephen Riley about his film. Stephen Riley has directed the documentary films Blue Blood, Fire in Babylon, Everything or Nothing, which is about the enduring cinematic appeal of James Bond. He is joining us today from a studio in Hollywood. And Stephen Riley, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I guess I wanted to begin by asking, before you embarked on this project, what did you, I mean, beyond seeing him on screen, what did you know about Marlon Brando? Much of anything?
Not too much, really, at all. I was a big fan of, several of his movies, the big movies, I guess, Godfather, loved Apocalypse, Last Tango as well, but... I was starting very much from a point of ignorance. I knew that he'd been reclusive. I kind of subscribed to the popular myth of him being wasn't he a bit mad? And something terrible happened inside his family home. And those were kind of just scraps of details, really, that I think probably a lot of people share. And I tried to keep hold of that, keep hold of my lack of knowledge when at least trying to provide an adequate introduction to Marlon and to allow people to get into what undoubtedly became, even for my research, a much more complex and complicated story.
When did you first learn about these tapes, these boxes of tapes?
Apparent that there was an archive, but the archive was actually at the time the film was being made was growing and growing, and the reason for that was that Marlon's boxes, all of his personal effects that had been in storage for since his death, so that had been 10 years, were just being unpacked at the time. So the producers had been in touch with the Brando estate with regard to making a film. And once that trust had been developed The team had all been introduced then, and then I was brought in to develop the story and direct the film. One of the first questions that comes up is, what have we got access to? What's available? And the answer was, everything that that we have. But it was a surprise to everyone exactly how much there ended up being. Certainly in terms of these tapes. I mean, I had access to a handful of tapes initially, which had been digitized, and in amongst those there was some very interesting material, including some self-hypnosis tapes that Marlon was actually making for himself in the aftermath of his daughter's suicide. He was he was definitely experiencing some fairly severe symptoms of stress, and was using these tapes to meditate and to bring himself under into regressive hypnotherapy, to take himself back into his childhood, and to target and to access sort of sources of his own trauma that go right back to his early days. And he was very keen to solve that, and throughout his life to find not just meaning through therapy, but also some measure of relief for the emotional difficulties, which I think he felt he sustained in his early years.
So you're listening to these tapes, and you're, I'm sure, like most of us, you're intrigued. I mean, this is Marlon Brando trying to hypnotize himself and say these things about his life. But did you think, in at least in those early days, this is how I'll construct the film? I won't use other interviews. I'll just let Marlon tell the story.
I did, yeah. It was a bit of a far-fetched idea, as I said, from this very first collection of tapes. When I listened to them, I just had a thought that, God, can you imagine how incredible it would be if Marlon was the only voice in the film, and he could deliver this entire story. But again, that was a bit fanciful. It was the basis for my first proposal, which had the same title of "Listen to Me, Marlon," which was actually taken from one of the self-hypnosis tapes that I mentioned. And that's really what was presented, and I wanted it to be this psychoanalytical piece of Brando, in some way conducting a post-mortem on his own life from beyond the grave, and trying to figure out how he came to be the person he was, and how the events and the tragic events, even in his household, ever came to pass. But I wasn't so sure even at that point that that would ever be possible, because there wasn't really a precedent for a documentary to have been told entirely in the voice of a deceased person, let alone with an attempt at doing a structured narrative. So I went out to the States and went to meet as many people as I possibly could from Marlon's life, to research the piece and interview them, just in case I needed to have talking heads in the film, and if I needed to, film people to make sure that I actually delivered something. But it was interesting, that process, as educative and useful as it was for me to later access and understand the material on the tapes. When I was interviewing these people, I found that his life became ever more complicated, because Marlon kept a lot of his relationships separate and compartmentalized. And I discovered that, people might, he might have had friends for a while, then the friendship would have turned sour for even a trivial reason, and they'd be off the map for a bit, and then there'll be somebody new who he'd relate to, maybe even just over the phone. And so there was lots of people in his life, but as I said, it was very fragmented. And there was no single voice who might be able to really bind all of Marlon's story together. So I just became ever more attached to my first thought of actually how much more single-minded and clear would the film be if Marlon, again, was the person solving this riddle for us, of who was the real Marlon Brando and who was the man behind the myth. Let Marlon explain that himself.
Let me play a piece of tape from the film. This is one of the things you notice about Marlon Brando is, at least for me, it surprised me in some way, because I guess I thought the popular belief of him being really erratic and a little crazy in the latter part of his life. But one thing you notice throughout, and even though there are those moments where he does clearly seem erratic. He also seems really self-conscious, not in a naive way. I mean, his impressions throughout the film about – and he comes to this kind of epiphany about the fact you have to analyze yourself, and he really seems to be doing that well. He seems it seems really insightful, some of the conclusions he's coming to about his life. And there's this piece of tape early on, and the way you've positioned it throughout the film, it's Brando telling us essentially what this film is about. I mean, he's keenly aware of his circumstance at the latter part of his life, and as you hear in this clip, he's reflecting back.
We establish that he's a troubled man, alone, beset with memories, in a state of confusion and sadness, isolation, disorder. He's wounded beyond being able to be social in an ordinary way, and he becomes like a mechanical doll. Maybe he felt that he was treated badly, and that he's angry about the treatment. He's collecting bits of information here, odd bits of film, to try to explain, why are you this way?
Stephen Riley, you've talked about that there was kind of this question that would hang over you during the project, and it was whether or not you yourself liked Marlon Brando. Would you talk a little bit about that? Why did you think that might be important, whether you liked him or not?
Well, I really couldn't. It was a long time before I could really get my head around things and figure him out. I had picked up every book I could that was written, whether from ex-lovers or friends or work colleagues, just and other biographies, and all of them seemed to give a slightly conflicting view of Marlon. Some of them didn't deliver the most favourable view. I mean, and he could come across as a difficult and unlikable character, yeah, in some of them. And I was just thinking, well, is that the person I'm going to discover as well? And I was very open to really find out who this person was, didn't really have my own value judgments at all. So it was So by stages, I got to understand his contradictions. I realised that he could have awkward traits and negative aspects, as we all do. Mm-hmm. He said that he was wrestling with all sorts of problems, again, going back to his youth, whether it was his own sense of inferiority, his troubles with authority as well. He had big trust issues. He had issues with rage that he speaks about very eloquently. Mm-hmm. In context, and especially the context which Marlon delivers himself, I mean, he's the person investigating his own problems. I found that endearing, yeah. I found his honesty just very inspiring in a way, and he's trying to solve a lot of the problems that I think we all do in our lives, relating to, who we are and what our insecurities are and the troubles of our upbringing. I found his company very enlightening and enjoyable. He had a great sense of humour as well. I mean, it was a joy to listen to the tapes, and there'd always be some sort of surprise moment. I could look many times within a day where Marlon would cheer me up, I you're spending a lot of time with the character through the course of the edit. It was a 9-month edit, so I had Marlon on headphones for a lot of that time. Then you really get to know him, and it was as I said, it was nice to get to a point where I actually did like the guy, and could celebrate him genuinely on a few levels. Not just as the greatest actor as he's reputed to be, but also as a very thoughtful and intellectual man with some forward thinking ideas.
Mm-hmm. There are a few themes in the film. In his life, but it seems like he made that reference in that last clip to when you become a mechanical doll, and that seems like a really important theme, in a big one, I think, in his life, because it was about truth And that seems to be what he was getting at as an artist. And you see this kind of arc. At first, he's all about honesty and truth, and then he becomes disillusioned. But that idea of freedom, wanting to be free, seems like a really important idea for Marlon Brando.
There was that. I mean, I think he felt trapped, unfortunately, for the majority of his life. Yeah. I think there's rare moments where he did find freedom, and rare places. He found the household of his upbringing very suffocating. Both his parents were alcoholics. His father was very abusive towards his mother, and that home was a prison in a way. And as Marlon describes, that's where he first developed his addiction to food for comfort eating because of the chaos of that household. And he speaks with this unabandoned glee of the fact when he first took a train to New York and left home, and when he ventured to New York where he very soon become an actor on Broadway, and that journey was his ultimate expression of freedom. Was being on that train.
Can I play a clip from actually this moment in the film? Because it seems like he explains that he has this unquenchable curiosity about people. And of course, no one knows who he is in those days. So he's wandering around New York. And I think this comes back later in the film, at least for me, this idea, as soon as people started recognizing him, and I'm sure a lot of actors feel this way. You no longer can be anonymous, but he has this sense of glee in these early days when he, as you say, arrives in New York and he's looking at people and looking at their faces.
I like to walk down the street and look at faces. I used to go into the corner of Broadway and 42nd Street in an Optimo cigar store. I would watch people for 3 seconds as they went by and try to analyze their personalities by just that flick. The face can hide many things, and people are always hiding things. I was always interested to guess the things that people did not know about themselves.
What they feel, what they think, why they feel. How is it that we behave the way we do?
What is the answer? Is there any answer? There's something that you need very deeply, some kind of contact, some experience to give you a sense of fulfillment.
You know, what I got from that moment was that he didn't set out to be an actor necessarily, but that was the act he found to give him a sense of fulfillment. Is that right, do you think?
I think there was something accidental about him getting involved in acting for sure. But there was also something predestined as well. His mother was an actress. One of his sisters was an actress too, who was already living in New York. I think that subconsciously there was an attempt to please his mother by becoming an actor. In fact, so it was you know, he was kind of drawn towards the New School, which is where he met Stella Adler, who was his main acting teacher, who he gives most credit to for helping him develop his version of the method. There was a combination really of these accidental factors and something which I think was just more predestined.
Stephen Riley is with us. He directed, wrote, and edited the new documentary film Listen to Me, Marlon. We're going to take a brief break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program we have with us the director Stephen Riley. We're talking about his extraordinary new documentary film, Listen to Me, Marlon. It's screening across the country. It's here in Salt Lake City at the Broadway Center Cinemas. We'll give you more details about that as we go along. It's about the actor Marlon Brando. It's this beautiful, really tragic portrait just using Brando's voice. Riley put all of this together. It's... I think, Stephen Riley, if you're an actor, you're going to love this film because it really gets at not just the way Brando worked, and you mentioned Stella Adler and method acting and those kinds of things, but he really breaks down the process of what it's like to get to the honesty of a character.
Yeah, I think there was, again, with many of the myths that surrounded Brando, one certainly was that he was quite uncultured. He wasn't very, he wasn't too smart, a lot of people felt. He was the mumbler, and he kind of, you know, just waltzed through his roles without studying too much. But what I found fascinating was how opposite that the truth was ended up being. And he was meticulous, Brando, in preparing for his parts, and I had access to all these tapes from the majority of his roles, where he was doing character studies and really trying to get under the skin of a character and breaking them down into their emotional side, their rational side, and filling his mind with all sorts of small details of personality and backstory that he could layer in his mind, and build this repository of study and of detail and facts that he could then forget when the director said action. He could have all of that there, so it was available just to forget again, and he could be spontaneous within the moment. And it was fascinating just getting a masterclass from him on how to act and how to approach each role in a different way, you know, and figuring out how to access parts of your own past. And for him, it was often, you know, very much an internal process. He liked the external as well. I mean, what I found fascinating about Brando was that, unlike many actors, you know, he was most happy when he wasn't playing himself, and he would often choose roles which were very removed from his own knowledge. And by that I mean sort of cross-cultural roles. You know, he did play a Mexican in Viva Zapata, played an Italian-American in The Godfather, played an Englishman on many occasions, including Mutiny on the Bounty, a German in The Young Lions. I mean, he would really, you know, push the boat out and change his entire persona and his entire appearance, and change accent. He was an incredible mimic, which is a skill that not many actors are gifted with. That was just another string to Brando's bow.
He uses this, there's this amazing section in the film, I want to play a clip from it, where he's expressing such hope and such passion, you know, about how good it can feel when you're immersed in a role and how honest you can feel. And he uses this boxing metaphor. And this is an image and a metaphor you use kind of throughout the film a little bit. I guess he saw a connection between the fight and his work on some level. Would you say something about that before I play this clip?
So he was a big fan of there was Sugar Ray Robinson and also Judge Joe Walcott. And Judge Joe Walcott is a boxer featured in the movie, who he describes as someone who was incredibly unpredictable. Who would do, with the use of feints and body movement, would make you think that a punch was coming from somewhere, but then it would be the knockout blow would come from the other direction. And that's how he felt acting should be as well, that you should never let the audience be able to predict what's coming next and always keep that sense of volatility in the scene. That's what he applied. He thought that was relevant to boxing as it was in acting.
People will mythologize you no matter what you do.
There's something absurd about it, that people go with hard-earned cash into a darkened room where they sit and they look at a crystalline screen upon which images move around and speak. And the reason they don't have light in the theater is because you are there with your fantasy. The person up on the screen is doing all the things that you want to do. They're kissing the woman you want to kiss, hitting the people you want to hit, being brave in a way that you want to be brave. The audience will lend themselves to the subject. They will create things that are not there.
Listen to me, Terry. Take the job. Just take it. No questions. Take it.
There are times I know I did much better acting than in that scene on the waterfront.
You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody instead of a bum, which is what I am. Let's face it.
It had nothing to do with me.
The audience does the work.
They are doing the acting. Everybody feels like they're a failure. Everybody feels they could have been a contender.
I thought that insight was really interesting. He seemed really conflicted about the idea of fantasy, the part of fantasy, because that escape was important for him when he was a kid. But then later he comes to be disillusioned by it. I mean, he calls it acting lying. I don't know. This was so interesting. This was one of those contradictions, it seems, for Marlon mm-hmm. Brando in his life, don't you think? That on one yeah. hand, he had disdain for audiences who were watching this, and on the other hand, he was absolutely one of them.
I think it represented more broadly the failings of his own search for truth and meaning. You know, as a young man, he was incredibly idealistic. He really was convinced that there was the light. You know, there were universal answers and there could be absolute meaning. And that's what he sort of dedicated himself to finding out and then to representing on stage and on screen. But I think he, you know, by stages, didn't just become more disillusioned with acting or with Hollywood, but also with human nature. Yeah. You know, he really did try to, he thought that we could change the world by the dissemination and the spreading of positive messages and positive ideas. But he just got more consumed by the fact that that people don't really know the truth, and he was fascinated by how willing we are to relinquish truth to myth. Every opportunity, and we lose track of the reality very quickly. Whether that's in the myth of the mother, you know, the myth of the ideal woman, the myth of America, the myth of justice, and all these other virtues that America stands for as well, which was something that was very important to him. So it was it was a constant struggle between myth and reality, not just in his craft, but behind the scenes and how he regarded all of our interactions, and he felt. Kind of in an existential way that you know, every person that you meet, you are lying to. You're presenting a version of yourself that you want them to accept. You know, all of us want to be accepted, and when we change our character every day, and we lie every day in most of our daily meetings with people.
You know, there's this amazing moment in the film. It's the premiere for Guys and Dolls, and people are screaming and just mobbing Marlon Brando. And he approaches the microphone at the front, and he's talking with this woman, and she's kind of mystified at how horrified he is by this mob, I want to play just a moment from this moment. Do you want to talk a little bit about this? Because I thought that was so interesting. She's delighted by the fact that everyone's so excited about this film. And he's really mystified and horrified by it.
Oh, it's just one of those moments when I remember going through the archive and I saw it, this moment you're mentioning where Marlon is clearly visibly flustered by the attention that he's getting. Bearing in mind, he was kind of the prototype for all that female hysteria and mania that would, you know, become associated with the Elvis and the Beatles. I mean, Brando was the kind of the testing ground for all that stuff. He was leading the charge, and he found it very difficult to deal with. He was mobbed by these women, and he felt terrified. So you can't disguise that. I mean, if people were ever sort of wondering, you know, did Brando want fame? You see moments like that, and you can see, you know, it actually physically rattled him, and he was always he felt that every time he spoke to. You know, if you ask somebody whether fame is something that that everyone would like. I mean, you know, most people can't understand the fact that that Brando didn't desire fame, because you know we all think that would be, you know, the best thing on earth or a bonus. But you know, for Brando, it was really a nightmare, and one that he felt he could never really explain, because it was something you had to experience to fully understand.
Most actors want to get their name in the paper. They like all that attention.
I very often am struck with the illusion of success. Sometimes it's difficult when you meet people because you see that they've prejudged you. Not to be treated normally. To have people staring at you like an animal in the zoo, or some strange creature from a distant land.
What it does is remove you from reality. I can't stand it. I hate it. I have no idea how discomforting it is not to be able to be just an ordinary person.
You can't imagine how much of a panic it is. Really, it scared me to death, because they were hanging on. They could have been run over or crushed. It really is... I've never seen a really hysterical crowd, and
they
it's a
are
frightening experience.
I want to talk about this digital image of Brando that we see in the film. And you've talked about how you were actually looking for some way to kind of bring Brando back to life in some way. And then this this idea, this digitized image presents itself. Talk about this moment.
There was a challenge, along with doing the film or editing the film entirely in Brando's own words, using the tapes. Then there was obviously the question about how to cover it visually, and how to, you know, create a visual scape for the movie. And part of that was to reconstruct Marlon's home. His actual home has been was broken down, destroyed after his death. But I wanted to reconstruct the house, which would become so symbolic as certainly as the place of where Marlon had become reclusive, yeah, up in his home in Mulholland Drive, and also because it was the venue for the shooting where his son had shot the boyfriend of his daughter Cheyenne within that home. The media had called the place, the House of Pain. Yeah. So I was keen in for several reasons to rebuild that space and have it as the scene of the investigation, where Marlon is trying to figure out the what went wrong and what were the problems of his life. And he had a bunker outside of his home where he stored boxes of all his old keepsakes and memorabilia, and the idea was that these boxes would now be in the house, being unpacked, and Marlon is going through the unpacking the evidence of his life to figure the problems out. So as part of the visuals were to sit to do with the reconstruction of this house and the situating of archive within that space, and to move the camera within the house, so it was almost reflected Marlon's point of view.
Right.
It was his POV, and a ghostly presence, you know, that would suggest that Marlon was still present within the home. And allied with that is this 3D head that you mention, which is a 3D digitized moving head of Marlon, which appears on a screen within that house, but also goes to full screen. And how that came about, it was an amazing find within the archive. We tracked down a friend of Marlon's who was a special effects supervisor who'd done a 3D scan, full 3D scan of Marlon's head, which is incredibly detailed, and it went right down to the actual detail of Marlon's pores in his skin.
Yeah.
Marlon had sat down with this friend of his, Scott Billups, had this scan done, and had spoken about it on the tapes as well, about how he felt that in the future that actors wouldn't even need to turn up on set, that they wouldn't need to be real,
yeah.
Which probably appealed to him, appealed to his lazier aspects.
Right.
Marlon would have enjoyed that.
And his sense of fatalism, I think, as well, because that's sort of expressed by Marlon from time to time.
Yeah, I think... I see what you mean as well. He was very forward thinking in many regards. You know, in terms of about the environment and society and technology, and actually this was probably also an expression of that he just liked to have one foot in the future, and so having his head scanned, I think would have excited him, and he would have found that great fun. But it was nice in the movie to deliver on what Marlon actually predicts, because he says that actors will be inside a computer and they will deliver their performances that way. And so the documentary does that, because we had great animators at the production company Passion Pictures in London who could work with this scan, and also an actor that I had come in and would lip sync to Marlon's voice. So the actor would be speaking the lines. We'd be filming that on motion capture cameras, so that we could then map it to the digitized head of Brando, so to bring Marlon back to life in this digitized form. So Marlon's head was almost like this ghost in the machine.
Yeah.
Device within the film, where he's talking directly to the audience, delivering this last performance, but when you see the effect of the head, which is very broken and digitized, that was also to reflect Marlon's search for meaning as well within the film.
Yeah.
It's hard to
capture that with in just in audio on the radio. But I want to play a moment as we head into a break, where he's delivering this beautiful soliloquy from Macbeth. Gives you a sense, anyway, of what that might sound like. Stephen Riley is with us. His film is Listen to Me, Marlon. It's currently screening across the country, including here in Salt Lake City at the Broadway Center Cinemas. We have details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another break and be back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllables of recorded time, and all our yesterdays of lighted fools their way to dusty death. Out brief candle, life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound, fury, signifying nothing.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Back now with director Stephen Riley. We're talking about his film, Listen to Me, Marlon, about Marlon Brando, of course, screening across the country, including here in Salt Lake City. We have details about that a little bit later on the program. Stephen Riley is joining us today from a studio in Hollywood. Let's talk about his experience with the film Mutiny on the Bounty. He wants to make pictures that were meaningful. And then he begins to choose films that didn't really live up to that. And Mutiny on the Bounty is one of those films that he had a terrible experience. I mean, he comes in contact with his fantasy land, Tahiti, which is a good thing. But he didn't. It was a really difficult experience. And maybe we should start this way. You've actually said, I'm not sure if this is right or not, this is your favorite Marlon Brando film?
I kind of always dodge this question. I don't really have a favorite one. It's among them, actually, though. I do. Yeah, I think. And probably because of all the things you mentioned, that there was so much going on behind the scenes, that it's interesting knowing the backstory while you watch that film too, because it was a very, very formative film for Marlon and very relevant for the rest of his life.
Talk about why. I mean, one of them that emerges, this idea is, and this goes back to his experience as a young man, his father, who's this sort of violent, can be anyway, conflicted figure in his life throughout, sends him to military school. And so I think the experience of him being a military man, playing a military man, being put upon by his commander, and then being put upon beside that, the director of the film, all seems to come together, and he really bristles in that experience.
Yeah, I think it's a perfect storm for a lot of the stuff which Marlon was dealing with from when he was younger. His dad, as you mentioned, sent him to military school, which was the same school that his dad himself had once gone to. His dad was very much a masculine type, expected the same of Marlon, but Marlon, I think, was just he was just non-conformist, couldn't stand anything that the military offered. And was quite, you know, sensitive and felt very lonely when he was there and didn't fit in so well. So would go to the library and just thumb through old editions of the National Geographic magazine. And inside the National Geographic magazine were images of Tahiti. Mm. And he'd lose himself in daydreams as a young boy of going to this faraway paradise. And then all of a sudden, when his several films in, when his fame's taking hold, he's given the chance to go to Tahiti. In fact, he was offered to go to play Lawrence of Arabia, which is, but he turned that role down to do Mutiny on the Bounty, just so he could get a chance to go to Tahiti, and it was everything that he dreamed of. He says, and that's where he ended up making his home and finding his retreat and sanctuary from away from the fame and other associated problems of Hollywood. He bought an archipelago, yeah, called Tetiaroa. And made that his home for many decades.
I think the thing that he likes about Tahiti in part, and this goes again to one of the themes of the film, is this idea of truth. Is he found the people there, he mentions their unmanaged faces and how they were, you couldn't lay dollars down on a table and have them sell their soul, is what the way he puts it. I mean, he just has this deep affection for this kind of genuine, these genuine people, and as you say, it becomes it was very important to him. I mean, it changes his life, really, I think, that experience.
I think he just always wanted to be normal.
Yeah.
You know, he was just, I think he was used to living an ordinary life. I mean, apart from the dysfunction, you know, he lived an ordinary life in Nebraska and in Illinois and in places where he moved as a young boy. You know, in Tahiti offered him that. You know, people just didn't have a clue who he was, and he could be anonymous, and that was very, very important to him. He could be the voyeur again. You know, he could be that guy who could sit and watch people and not be the person who was hunted and watched himself.
At what point do you think Stephen Riley, Marlon Brando, becomes really cynical about the process? Because, and this is what's so, I think I have to say, so fascinating about the film. In those early days, he's talking about the passion of telling the truth as being an actor, and it's not long before he is cynical about it, less it being about art and truth and more about it being, as he says in this clip from the film, just a business.
There's an old adage in Hollywood. They say, if you have a message, go to Western Union.
I didn't make any great movies. There's no such thing as a great movie. In the kingdom of the blind, the man with one eye is the king.
There are no artists. We are businessmen. We're merchants. And there is no art.
Agents, lawyers, publicity people.
It's all.
Money, money, money. If you think it's about something else, you're going to be bruised.
Talk a little bit about that, if you would, because this is, acting stops fulfilling him, and he turns to other causes, civil rights, the rights of the American Indian.
Yeah, I think he really wanted to very often, in fact, in most cases, convey a message in his films. And as you hear him say there, you know, if you have a message, go to Western Union. He just felt that Hollywood wasn't interested in that kind of thing and that it was all about commerce. And that really wasn't where his priorities were at. And there was quite a few times when I think he got involved in films with the best of intentions. I mean, for example, with Mutiny on the Bounty, what fascinated Brando was Act Three. You know, after the mutiny had taken place, how he wanted to answer this question. You know, what would you do if you had the chance to found a perfect society,
right,
as they did on Pitcairn's Island? What would that society look like? And so he was really desperate that the writers and the directors, the producers, you know, really, you know, paid attention to that section of the script. And And he was kind of, he felt that he was pushed to the sidelines and that the script was taken in different directions. And that was one of the sources of his creative angst, of his creative angst around that film. And true for many other films as well, is, you know, Viva Zapata,
Apocalypse Now, for sure. I mean, he absolutely didn't think Francis Ford Coppola got that character of Kurtz, or the film itself, I think. And he, as he says in one of the tapes you play, he rewrote the script, and he says, "I have it on tape."
That's it. I mean, you know, with the character of Kurtz, you know, bearing in mind when Brando arrived on the set of Apocalypse Now, as Coppola freely confesses, there wasn't a script. There, you know, they were trying to figure out Act Three for that film,
right,
and figure out how they were going to close it. And Coppola speaks about how he had a choice. You know, did he just call halt to this production, which was already running hugely over budget, and go and do rewrites of the script, or do you sit down and try and do improvisations with, you know, the best actor on the planet, which is Brando? He chose the latter, and then Brando was off, and I had tapes and tapes of Brando who was just trying to channel the character of Kurtz and developing a character, a kind of character that Brando felt Kurtz should be. He thought it was Brando's suggestion that Kurtz be supremely rational, and Brando wanted to develop this character of someone who was entirely evil, but could almost justify evil and justify genocide. And how well could sharpen your logic to justify such terrible acts? Because Brando wanted to point out some things to humanity as well. That really getting us to explore the nature of good and evil within ourselves and understand our own hypocrisy, you know, that we might think that we're completely, you know, sort of whiter than white and good people, but any one of us are always, you know, very close to something, you know, doing something terribly bad if the circumstances allowed. And so Kurtz was a kind of exploration of the evil within us all. He wanted to put, you know, hold that mirror up, you know, hold a light up to our own behaviours, even through an abominable character like Kurtz. Even where it's not so obvious, you know, Brando was always trying to bring a message to where he could to his films, to his characters.
I think this is a side of that story, though, that you don't often get. I mean, what you hear is the popular stories of him arriving on set unprepared and overweight, and that he was notoriously difficult to work with. But the sense you get from this story, and I think from others, to be honest with you, of the others of the stories that you tell in the film, is that it was more complicated than that. That he had a point of view, that he had something to bring to all of this, and that people just were looking at him, as he said, as a mechanical doll, not as a contributor. And it seems like that's the role he wanted to play as an actor.
Yeah, I think he was frustrated when he didn't have a message to deliver. Mm-hmm. You know, he'd always find a way to work that into the script. You know, and he often had that within his contract that he had the right to see the first draft and to make amends, and that was it. Yeah, he'd want to implant a message wherever he could, and then when he found that, when he thought that Hollywood wasn't a good vehicle for that anymore, that's when he really started applying himself to doing civil rights causes and actually, you know, pounding the pavement and joining the marches and getting involved in a more proactive way and not relying upon film to convey the messages that he wanted to share.
It's interesting that he does toward the end there, and I don't want to give away too much, but he does kind of come around in his thinking about acting, at least in some way, that actors can make a contribution. That does seem to kind of complete the arc of the way he was thinking about it. I mean, passion and then cynicism and then maybe rethinking it.
Well, that's just it. I mean, you're forever juggling, you know, idealism and cynicism with Brando, or rather he was juggling them himself. And he could do that, you know, even in the course of a single day. You know, he could wake up and be full of optimism and yet that might have, by the end of the day, if he'd had a rough phone call with a Hollywood exec, he'd be seething about his profession again. Right. But he was a perfectionist. You know, I'm sure of that, and I think he really wanted to produce good work and good art, and remained optimistic and idealist throughout his life. But did wrestle. I think he did. He did struggle with, what was the real purpose of acting, and did it serve any function at all? But certainly towards the end of his life, I think he'd reconciled himself to that question. And I think looking back on his body of work, he understood that he had done lots of good,
yeah.
And allowed people, not just a chance to escape themselves through film. But to access, higher thoughts and higher ideals and concepts, which is what gifts us with.
Yeah. Let me ask you this finally, about a minute left. I mean, he is laid bare in this film. I mean, even the moments of self-hypnosis where he's trying to convince himself to stop eating brownies and apple pie, because he's gaining so much weight. I mean, he is really vulnerable, obviously. And I wondered, was there anything too private that you thought, you don't have to share it with us, obviously, but you figured you couldn't share everything, something, you should leave something out?
I'll be completely honest, no. There's so much, I guess, sensitive material within the film. Marlon talks about his many addictions. He talks about all of the very traumatic experiences of his own upbringing, and the death in the household. I mean, the film goes there because Marlon goes there. I mean, he's the one talking about all of this, and I think it's only because he's the person describing it that we can go to those places. But there was nothing that was off limits in that regard.
Stephen Riley. His documentary is called Listen to Me, Marlon. It's now screening at theaters across the country. Here in Utah, you can see it at the Broadway Center Cinemas in downtown Salt Lake. The details to that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Stephen Riley, thanks for the time.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.